You're listening to a podcast from the Institute for Research on Poverty at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I'm Dave Chancellor. For this May 2013 podcast, we're going to talk about how we think about the way that people make decisions in the context of poverty. At some level, almost any type of program or service that caters to low-income people makes a certain set of assumptions, usually not overtly, but about the way that those people will use the program. Crystal Hall, a psychologist at the University of Washington's Evans School of Public Affairs, has been doing work to learn how we can apply insights from social or cognitive psychology to understand decision-making in the context of poverty. Hall spoke at IRP in April of this year and sat down with me to talk about some of the early findings in her research. To start, let's look at the general theory behind this work.
This idea that when we look at the behavior of people that don't have very many resources, it's not just about people not having the ability to make the right decisions. It's not that they have, you know, a different capability or different psychology. It's that they're really influenced by the constraints that they face in the social context that they're in.
Hall's recent work primarily focuses on asset building and the way that people make financial decisions. She has also started work looking at housing choice and the processes that people go through when they're deciding where to live.
The way that I've been tying all of that together lately is thinking about it in the context of the assumptions that are made about behavior when we design and implement policy. And so this idea that very often the people that are designing policy and are setting up these programs for other people to use don't have the same perspective that they have and don't have the same constraints in the same context. And so sometimes that results in assumptions that are a little bit off or in just kind of incomplete potentially, and that can be really inefficient and costly in the way that we decide to implement policy.
As we start to think about the sorts of assumptions that might affect how policy and program interactions are developed, Hall cautions that these assumptions are rarely explicit, but that it's a real challenge to understand all of the different factors that might make a difference in terms of a person's success with a program or service.
I think it's very, very difficult for someone that isn't really, you know, living paycheck to paycheck and constantly making all these trade-offs in terms of how they use their money. I think it's really hard to imagine how those individuals would operate in that context. And so I think it's important to keep in mind that it's not that people are necessarily, that policymakers are necessarily making these explicit assumptions. And I think a lot of the assumptions are around this idea that low-income individuals need assistance and that they will respond to assistance that they're offered without responding to any of the other sources of noise that are in the way.
Hall points to the example of the Earned Income Tax Credit, which is a major benefit for low-income Americans and one that we know lots of people don't always take up. She says that part of what we're assuming about the EITC is that people don't know about it or don't know how to get it.
But what we found in some of my research is that potentially one source of kind of distraction from that goal for individuals could be the fact that they're in a context that makes them extremely uncomfortable psychologically, and that the impact of their stigma can be very large on their behavior because we approach folks in these contexts in which their poverty is very, very salient. And so one might assume that we would expect low-income individuals to be more motivated by the fact that they're being offered some benefit.
Hall says this doesn't have to be something big like a tax refund. It's very common to hear about people being ashamed to use a soup kitchen or a food pantry, but in the case of a bigger and more complicated decision, that psychological discomfort can be one component or one step in the larger process that makes it difficult for someone to achieve the outcome they want.
This is something that isn't unique to this population. You can think of examples of this with other folks, with higher income folks as well, right? I think thinking about people's patterns around dieting and exercise, very, very similar. People have some explicit goals, and in their own social context, there are all these other things that get in the way. And often these steps that they have to take on the way end up detracting them from those overall goals.
These types of findings are probably not surprising, but they do raise the question of how we go about measuring these stops along the way when trying to achieve a goal, at least so far as it relates to a particular economic group. When Hall began doing this work, one of the tactics that she used was to take a strong finding from within the judgment and decision-making literature and apply it in the context of people that are very poor.
For example, my work on mental accounting and looking at people's willingness to travel to save different amount of money on a product came from a really robust finding within the field, and we were curious, would this hold with a low-income population? And we found out that it actually didn't. Low-income individuals actually looked more what we might call rational in those cases, which was really interesting. And I think also, you know, speaks to the fact that this isn't about these folks having a different psychology. They're perhaps just paying attention to different features of the choice because of the constraints that they face.
Hall says that her early work in this area was relatively straightforward, often just asking people for their opinions about hypothetical questions. However, currently she's working to develop more complex experiments and measures that test actual interventions and see what the real-world outcomes are.
Because when I talk to practitioners in particular about this work, it is very, very common that they say to me, okay, how can I use this, or how would this work in, you know, my setting when I'm approaching my clients? And those are questions that we can't answer right now. They're questions that I think are very important because these different types of service providers are working with their clients in these very, very complex social environments. And I think that the next stage to all of this research is really beginning to test how do these things operate when you're in these complicated environments.
So even if we can't answer these kinds of questions now, what sorts of observations might we expect to see, and how might these lead to better outcomes?
I've run into a lot of issues just around implementation of these things to begin with. And I guess I would answer that question by first saying, in my mind, the first stage to all of this is really understanding what's the behavior that you want to change and what's the context that it's all occurring in. Because I think that goes a long way to giving us some insight into what might work. And part of that process of understanding the context is really understanding where are people kind of falling off the boat. So, for example, if, you know, we're interested in people, if people say that they really want to have a bank account, and we give them an opportunity to sign up for a bank account in some situation, and they don't follow through with that, when we map that process, we can try to see what is it that's causing people to not do it, right? And where is it that we might be able to insert some type of nudge or some type of intervention?
Professor Hall cautions that the goal here isn't to completely dismantle existing programs, but perhaps to study particular aspects of the way that people interact with programs.
This type of work is not going to solve any problems overall, right? I think of this as a set of tools that's another set of tools that policymakers and advocates can use when working with this population.
As Hall continues with this work, she says that she will look for ways to make interventions work at the organizational level. She's already begun working with a Seattle credit union to identify areas in which small changes in behavior could lead to better financial outcomes for lower-income clients. Thanks to Crystal Hall for talking about this research. You've been listening to a podcast from the Institute for Research on Poverty.